KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is away on sabbatical for 5 months. I'll be keeping his chair warm till then. If long waits at the border between U.S. and Canada were not enough, what about charging Canadians money to come into the United States? It might be more hospitable than a fence proposed for our border with Mexico, but U.S. Congressman Brian Higgins says, no way are we going to charge our friendly Canadians to come into our country. Joining us with more on this and other stories, our regular Wednesday guest, Vaughn Palmer. Hello, Vaughn.
Hello, Marcy. So good to hear you.
It's nice to talk with you. Who came up with a border fee idea?
It comes up every now and then as a cash cow idea. A whole lot of Canadians come across the border, so we charge every one of them $5. You'd be talking real money pretty soon. But there's always been a resistance to it, and there's a lot of coverage on this side of the border because Congressman Brian Higgins, so he's the U.S. House of Representatives member for Western New York, which includes Buffalo.
Right.
And the reason he's interested in this is because going to Buffalo has been a tradition and a great getaway for people living in southern Ontario for a long time. And there's a hockey team there that a lot of Canadians patronize, the Sabres and the Buffalo Bills NFL franchise, and shopping and getting away from it all. Of course, it works the other way, too. There's arts festivals in Canada and all sorts of things people come across for. And there's cross-border shopping. So he says it's not going to happen. He says the Senator Schumer from New York, who's also a Democrat, isn't going to let it happen, and he's not going to let it happen in the House of Representatives, and the idea is a non-starter, and forget it and go away.
Well, I can understand Buffalo. We have quite a bit of cross-border traffic, too. I haven't heard much about this in the Washington State press.
No, I haven't either, and it's funny because I did hear the mayor of Bellingham on Vancouver radio talking about this, saying that obviously he would be opposed to it. You could follow right across the continent. Every border town is going to be saying the same thing. But I did hear the mayor of Bellingham. I haven't heard from Washington State senators and representatives on it yet, but I may have missed them. In any event, New York is not asleep at the switch on this one. They're already taking leadership and telling the government to forget about it. Yes, the American government needs money, but this is not one of the options it's going to have to come up with it.
I'm interested. Maybe you've talked with Steve about the other thing that may be crossing the border, which is marijuana, and this is specifically as the folks want to get into the White Rock, past White Rock, where the U.S. sort of is part of Canada, that little peninsula there. We can talk about that in weeks to come.
Yeah, I mean, there are two other things that, as you said off the top, there's other issues at the border. One of them, of course, is the furlough.
Right.
You're going to get lineups at the border. There's been widespread prediction of that. The other one is back and forth on the drug trade, although with Washington State being in the midst of liberalization, the problem may flow in the other direction. So we'll see. We are in the middle of an election in British Columbia, as you know.
Yep.
And in our election debate on Monday night, the question came up about decriminalizing marijuana. Adrian Dix, who is leading the opinion polls and perhaps poised to become the next premier of British Columbia, said he favors decriminalizing, but it would take federal law. A change of federal law, not a change of provincial law, to make that happen.
So the voters in the province of British Columbia can't do as voters in Washington State did?
No, there's a move here to amend the Provincial Police Act to essentially discourage the police from using resources on that issue. But I don't think that would actually work. Drugs are federal responsibility here. I mean, I know there's a clash on this in the states, too, right?
Yes, there is.
So, it's a similar situation here, and I think Dix is correct. If he becomes premier on the 14th of May, he'll have enough stuff to deal with without trying to change a federal law, which you really can't do provincially.
Well, so you mentioned Mr. Dix and marijuana. This is the halfway mark of your very nice and relievedly short election campaigns. How would you characterize it so far?
Well, we're 2 weeks in. Voting day is May 14th, so a little less than 2 weeks today. I don't think an awful lot has changed. The mood has been time for a change in British Columbia for quite a while. The government of Premier Christy Clark has been trailing in the polls for a long time, sometimes by as much as almost 20 points. We've had 19, we've had 17 points. Those are
wow.
Crushing gaps.
Yes.
We're expecting it to tighten up, but we had a radio debate last week with all four candidates and a TV debate on Monday night, and my sense was that it didn't change an awful lot. I mean, yes, I expect the gap will be closer at the end, but I still don't see the shift in the province away from the idea that after 12 years of government by the BC Liberals, I think the public's ready for a change.
In the past few months when I've sat in this chair and spoken with you, we've talked from time to time about Christy Clark sort of shooting herself in the foot, making various gaffes.
Yes.
So...
Oh, she had another one. My newspaper, the Vancouver Sun, ran a profile of her on the weekend, and in it, the reporter mentioned and wrote that while out on a trip with the premier, she's driving with her 11-year-old son in the car, taking him to a hockey practice. The premier ran a red light. She stopped at a red light. It's 5 a.m. The light's still red. She checks traffic both ways and drives through, which is running a red light, right? It's not like blasting through in the middle of the day, but it... And so that ran in the paper.
Oops.
And she got asked, and she said, well, it was only 5 o'clock in the morning. And then, of course, reporters go back at you. And then finally she said, okay, it was a mistake. I shouldn't have done it, right? It was wrong. Bad example for her son. And also, you know, the government here in British Columbia, her government, has been cracking down on dangerous driving, on reckless driving. They've been installing red light cameras. They've been trying to make the roads safer. So it's a double bad example in my view.
So she's out of there, it sounds like. Doesn't matter what she does.
I'd be very surprised if she can catch up. I mean, I don't think you ever say an election's over till it's over. It is up to the voters. We have seen elections in Canada in the last few years where the final result wasn't the one predicted by the opinion polls. But that's a big gap to make up, and I haven't seen anything that's really gone in her favor. So, it's not over till it's over, but the odds favor a change of government.
Vaughn, I was interested to read that the U.S. government last week released a list of gifts that President Obama and other federal officials received from foreign governments.
Yeah.
And you Canadians, the reason we have to charge you a fee to cross the border is because you're not very generous.
So Sarkozy of France, right, gave the president something like $40,000 worth of stuff, right?
Yep.
Like, it's sort of embarrassing. So what do we give the president? So we know our prime minister, our government knows that Obama's a basketball fan. So Prime Minister Stephen Harper gave him a basketball signed by all the members of the Toronto Raptors in the NBA. And it was presented to him, this is sort of nifty, in a plastic display case inside a green leather-bound box with the official seal of our prime minister on the top of it. I'm sure that's a treasured memento in the White House.
He didn't just give a basketball, though.
No. Well, we gave him something else. This is a little nicer. A gold frame, 19th century antique map of North America, surrounded by drawings of North American Indians and, of course, we're Canadians, beavers. total estimated value of the two gifts, that's the basketball and the map, $1,880 Canadian. We also, I see, gave the Undersecretary for International Affairs a Canada Goose Parker and sealskin mitts. And the Canadian government also spent $20,000 on parkas for participants in a G7 finance ministers meeting, which was held in Nunavut, which is,
right,
I think, above the Arctic Circle. So you wanted that one. My favorite detail in this story, however, is what President Obama gave Stephen Harper.
It wasn't that much better than a basketball.
A Hawaiian silk shirt.
Right.
Now, with all due respect to the president and his fondness for Hawaii, our prime minister is not really a Hawaiian shirt kind of guy. He's a sweater vest kind of guy, right? So, you know, if they're thinking about the president next time, it's not the money, it's the thought that counts, but a sweater vest would be a better president.
So these gifts are, these are sort of protocol. Maybe they could just do pens.
You know, like, can you not imagine that somewhere in North America there is a vast warehouse where all this stuff is put into storage because it's presents, so you can't just chuck it out. Someone might notice that. And I mean, you couldn't really
basketball.
Have a garage sale on the White House lawn after everybody leaves office. But there must be a staggering amount of this stuff accumulated out there somewhere.
I wonder if they put it in the Smithsonian Museum.
That... Not a nice stuff. I can't imagine the basketball is going to get there, but maybe the map might be there.
I don't know. A signed basketball. I mean, the president is a basketball fan, so maybe that, I don't know.
He'll take that with him when he goes.
Maybe. Well, last story is kind of nice. Last week, the movie 42 opened in the United States. That's the film about Jackie Robinson. And this gives us a chance not just to talk about baseball history, but a chapter in race relations, which was not included in the movie. I did not know that Jackie Robinson played in Montreal.
Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me that it's not in the movie because it's a different story, and I understand movies are, you know, a narrative, and you're trying to make a drama out of it, and what's in the movie is the story. But interesting story in the Globe and Mail this week, Ingrid Peretz in the Globe and Mail newspaper, just on Jackie Robinson's playing with the Montreal Royals in 1946, and Rachel Robinson, 90 years old, so she's still around, remembering fondly just how they were welcomed into the city. You know, it was a time, as she said, when it was difficult for African Americans to get into any kind of neighborhood. They found an apartment in Montreal. They were welcomed. Their neighbors were nice. A lot of their neighbors spoke French, so they could only communicate with them in sign languages, but no one was giving each other the finger. And the team welcomed them. The fans welcomed them. It's just a sweet story about him and about them. And yeah, Canada has its racial problems, particularly with Native Canadians or Aboriginal Canadians, but so, you know, we're not claiming we have clean hands, but we didn't have the division over African Americans that you did in the United States. So they had a wonderful season there in 1946. I think they won the Little League World Series, the Little World Series. The fans hoisted, this is a nice detail, the fans hoisted, at the end of the game, the fans hoisted, Robinson led the, scored the final run and led the Montreal Royals to the championship. Delirious fans hoisted Mr. Robinson onto their shoulders and mobbed him when he emerged after the game and chased him, actually. Sports reporter Sam Moulton observed in those days it was probably the only day in history that a black man ran from a white mob with love instead of lynching on his mind.
It was a great little detail. In reading this story, I couldn't help think about the many African Americans in the early to mid 20th century who got that kind of reception in Paris and European capitals.
And Canada was one of the destinations on the Underground Railroad. There's people have written histories about that. There's a significant African Canadian population in Halifax in Canada. That some of whom date their ancestry back to those days. It's a little like the stories out of Paris, particularly with the jazz musicians,
right.
And maybe somebody else will make a movie about that because it's an interesting story for Robinson.
It's probably too sweet, Vaughn. You need to have like people being punched out or having stuff thrown at them.
There's a place in the world for sweetness, too.
And we end on that very sugary note. Vaughn, thanks for being with us today.
Bye-bye.
Vaughn Palmer's a columnist for the Vancouver Sun. He's a regular Wednesday guest here on Weekday on KUOW.
Some movies, like the classic film 2001, A Space Odyssey, tell their story mostly with pictures, very little dialogue. Film critic Robert Horton has been thinking about these sorts of movies, nonverbal movies, if you will,
And he joins us to talk about that in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral degrees in 40 programs. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
52 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 64 this afternoon with sun all day. Tomorrow it's going to be sunny again, getting up to 70. And currently the forecast shows sunny days and daytime temperatures in the 70s all the way through Tuesday. Buying your groceries online and having them delivered is better for the environment than driving to the store yourself, according to a recent study. So, how are those online grocery delivery services doing these days? We'll find out in 20 minutes.
Well, that's such a momentous introduction. With the radiating halo behind him, it is time for a conversation with film critic Robert Horton. Yes.
What is that large black monolith that accompanied me in here? Anyway, I don't... It's confusing. Well,
Thus Spoke Zarathustra is the music, but you might know it better as the theme from 2001, A Space Odyssey. Thanks, Bernard, for pulling that one. Well, Robert... I take it that you've rewatched 2001, so we were going to talk about movies that aren't really about witty, snappy dialogue today.
Yeah.
Is this one of them?
Yes, it is. There were a couple of things that made me start to think about movies that are nonverbal, but still try to tell stories, or more or less stories, in a conventional way, and 2001 is one of them.
Well, I haven't seen... I mean, I'm not even sure what year did this come out. I haven't seen it since then.
1968.
All right, I haven't seen it since then. But is there a reason that you watched it again?
I watched it because I'm teaching class at Seattle University this quarter, and that was on the docket this week.
You told them that the students must watch
They had to watch 2001 A Space Odyssey, yes, and talk about it in class.
Uh-huh. Were you thinking specifically about its nonverbal characteristics when you assigned it?
No, not specifically, but it certainly hits you. It's a movie that operates kind of in a different zone from so many movies.
Well, for folks who have not heard of or seen this film, perhaps you want to talk about what it's about.
Oh, how much time have we got here? Let's see.
We have 18 minutes. That's not long enough.
I mean, by appearances, it's a science fiction story based on an Arthur C. Clarke tale directed by Stanley Kubrick in 1968 and possibly has something to do with some mysterious black monoliths that turn up at various points in human history and perhaps precipitate some kind of shift in evolution or at least a leap forward of some sort.
Why did you assign this to your students?
Well, it's actually a science fiction film class. So this is kind of the midpoint and unavoidable. And one wants to spend some time with this one. And I was I hadn't watched it in a few years myself, so it was great to sit down and look at it again and be reminded of how radical it remains, actually, as a film.
I was going to ask you, you could choose this for a science fiction class. You might choose this for a cinema history class as well.
Yeah, or like storytelling in cinema. There's a whole bunch of different ways you could do it, yeah, because it's a highly unusual film, and people will remember that it begins in prehistory with the dawn of man, with a bunch of apes verging on Homo sapiens, perhaps, and goes from there into the space age.
When you emailed and said you wanted to talk about films that focus on nonverbal, it kind of took me aback because cinema is a very visual medium.
Yeah.
So I would assume that any director, any filmmaker is really focused on visual storytelling, not so much audio storytelling.
Yeah, so the question is, aren't all movies nonverbal?
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, so many movies are so reliant on screenplay and dialogue to tell a story, and a lot of people seem to have forgotten you know, that original impulse.
Well, for example, Aaron Sorkin is about snappy dialogue.
Yes, definitely.
And there are many movies in the mid-20th century, the sort of Hepburn-Tracy movies, Hepburn movies in general, they're about witty repartee.
Yeah. And nothing against witty repartee.
I like it.
Dialogue is cool. And I was thinking just of this impulse, because I think it's coming back. I think in the last 20 years or so, there have been a lot of filmmakers around the world who have gotten interested in this idea of trying to find a new sort of movie form. You know, Kubrick at the time said that he was looking to do something that, while it examined, you know, who we are and what the purpose of existence is and all those sorts of things, that would also operate the way great music would.
Huh.
'Cause you don't go to Beethoven's Seventh Symphony and sit there thinking, where's the storyline? I'm not engaged because I don't identify with the characters. You just go with it and you have this experience that is nonverbal and it goes into your subconscious. And that was, Kubrick said, that's what explicitly what he wanted to do. He wanted to bypass consciousness in a way and make you see things, experience things in a new way. And 2001 still holds up as a movie that is not so much, gee, this happened and then that happened, but an experience that you live through. Or you just say, I'm bored. This is 20 minutes of watching spacecraft float around. I'm not into this.
There are many films that are coming to mind right now, but there's a reason that you chose this, and that there is a film coming out, I believe, this week that is about a visual artist, Auguste Renoir. I think it's Auguste Renoir that the film's about.
Yeah. It's a movie called Renoir, actually, is the title. And the coincidence of watching these two movies within a couple of days. Because I think this film, Renoir, which opens Friday, is an attempt to kind of get at a certain kind of visual storytelling. I mean, there's lots of dialogue and very, I think, all too conventional sorts of scenes of exposition and so on. I don't think it's a great movie. But you can kind of see them taking a stab at visual storytelling, probably because, hey, it's about a painter. It's about one of the most famous painters. Let's try to go that route a little bit.
I'm thinking of filmmakers. Is it Terrence Malick, who is really all about the sort of the effect of what we see as opposed to what we hear?
I think so. Well, of course, he's very careful about his soundtrack, too. But so it's dicey with him. But he would be one of the prime suspects in this conversation, I think. And it's interesting that Malick often reverts to voiceover narration, because he does seem to be such a Kubrickian, in the spirit of 2001, kind of filmmaker, and creating these dense images that are sometimes mystifying or whatever. But then he does kind of have this narration coming at you.
Does that happen, do you think, out of a maybe all of a sudden feeling like, oh, maybe people aren't going to get it, so I better give them some signposts?
It's so hard to tell with him, because he doesn't explain his films. And at times I think it's that, or at times it could be just maybe to him it's another layer of the experience, and you're not supposed to worry about every single word. It's just supposed to be part of the texture of it, you know. Malick doesn't give much away when he's explaining things, that's for sure.
No. Hans emails, what about Steve McQueen's 1970s classic Le Mans about the 24-hour car race? And he says he thinks the first words were spoken 20 minutes into the film.
Huh. It's been so long since I saw that movie, I don't remember that. But that movie would not have occurred to me as falling into this category. But hey, in the wake of 2001, people were doing all kinds of funny things, and that would have been right smack dab in the middle of it.
So Renoir is opening this weekend, and let's go from, you know, quiet visual storytelling, because there's another long-awaited, the first action film of the summer, I think, opens this weekend. I believe it's the first one of the summer, May 3rd. Summer starts May 3rd, and that is Iron Man 3.
Yes.
Not about visual storytelling necessarily, is it?
Yeah, not a huge reliance on it, although
I mean, it's visual.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those movies that is a spectacle, a summer movie spectacle, and so therefore it's got a zillion computer-generated special effects and all kinds of eye candy going on. I think it qualifies as the first movie of the summer. Yeah, I guess we're started now.
But movies like Iron Man 3, or there's I saw a trailer for another Superman movie that's opening later in the summer. There was sort of like a whole bunch of I wasn't actually at an action film, but that was what the trailers
Man
were.
Man of Steel.
Man of Steel, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
Those are meant not so much. I mean, there's a lot of action and nonverbal sequences because they're meant to be for global audiences, not
that's
necessarily
right.
to be about telling a story visually.
Yeah.
Am I right about that?
Yes. That is part of the deal that people discovered, I think, especially in the 1980s. When the international market became more and more important and the action film gained its ascendancy, in part because you didn't need that many words. So you were almost going back to, you know, that's why Stallone and Schwarzenegger became huge stars. And in a funny way, it was almost going back to the silent movie days, because if you were showing a Charlie Chaplin film, you didn't need to dub it. You didn't need to explain anything. That movie played in a small town in Africa the same way it played in Canada.
We're talking with Robert Horton, as we do most Wednesdays. And so then what's the line between a mostly visually told story like Iron Man or Man of Steel or Charlie Chaplin and 2001, which is also visual?
Yeah. I mean, the difference is that one of them doesn't really rely on the visual element, we can call it that, to tell its story. It's like the buttery flavoring poured on top.
Are you talking about Iron Man 3?
Yes, in this case, I'm talking about Iron Man 3. Although maybe I'm talking about Renoir too. I'm not sure. It's not a great movie. But you know, there's this impulse to pile that stuff on there as a carnival ride feature. Whereas in a film like 2001, or let's say some of Terrence Malick's films, it is the point itself. That's the thing. That's the journey. Is to immerse you as much as possible in some kind of visual experience. That if you did take the words away, you'd still have something that was close to the same kind of experience. Whereas Iron Man 3 and its ilk are this and this and this, and now we'll pause for 10 minutes of
boom,
wowing you.
Another movie that just popped into my head, I believe it's called The Long Day Closes. I'm not even sure.
Yeah.
It's from the 80s. Another movie that it requires, though, that maybe even 2001. These movies require you as an audience member to approach it differently than I would approach Man of Steel, which I'm looking forward to, by the way.
Yeah.
It looked good.
Yeah, nothing against
and Iron Man 3 as well.
For sure.
So how would you advise somebody who maybe doesn't go see this ilk, I'm going to try to give ilk a different spin than ilk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be a good film. How do I approach that? Because The Long Day Closes, I had a really hard time with, if I recall, because not much happened except a shadow got longer. That's all I remember.
Yes, and the film has a companion piece, Distant Voices, Still Lives, too, by the same filmmaker.
I believe I saw that one as well and didn't understand it.
Yes, and those are things that I think are also trying to bypass that half of our brain that demands story and so on. What you have to do is decide you're going to be open to that sort of experience and then go with it. And a movie like 2001 actually almost demands that you do that. And Kubrick, you know, within the first half hour or so of that movie is showing you these spaceships moving around to the Blue Danube waltz. And you might well be thinking, I got the point of this 5 minutes ago, so why is this still happening? And you can either check out of the movie at that point, or you can be drawn into... I mean, it practically is designed to change your alpha waves or whatever it is in your brain that changes the way you're thinking and come to this new sort of experience that Kubrick wants you to have. And that is, in fact, what the movie's about, which is changing consciousness in the form of a monolith, or maybe the monolith is the movie, and that's what's arrived to change you. And if you can go with that, then you may find yourself in an interesting place.
Or you could just listen to Thus Spoke Zarathustra.
Yes, indeed.
Joyce emails in the category of visually focused movies, Silent Light by Carlos Recatas.
Carlos Recatas, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good nomination. That's a Mexican filmmaker who's done very interesting work, and that's his most accessible film. But yes, Silent Light, good nomination.
And Jesse emails in Baraka, which I remember seeing. That's not right. That long ago.
Yeah, and Baraka, and its ilk. That's a slightly different thing too, because that is also sort of non-narrative. You know, like the Koyaanisqatsi mm-hmm. series of films, mm-hmm. and those movies are what they are. But and that's fine. Because they're related to this, but I'm also intrigued by the idea of maybe having the more Malick Kubrick zone, where you are sort of holding on to a storyline with characters, and yet you're also having this interesting new visual experience going on.
In that sense, they might share something with dance performances. A choreographer recently said to me, when you watch people walking around downtown Seattle, you're not trying to necessarily impart a story to the movements that they make, and he was saying that's how one should approach a sort of non-narrative dance piece. Are you telling me that's sort of the same thing I should do with
with
a visually perhaps non-narrative film?
Yeah, I'm in sympathy with that attitude, and it's what I always come back to is how willing we are to listen to music that does not have a meaning. You know, doesn't have lyrics that tell us what to think, or doesn't have lyrics at all, and yet we are greatly moved by it, and it stays with us. We are still whistling it a few days later, and so on. And we can do that with music, but it's tough with narrative things. We're wired to want the story, you know.
So your assignment, Grasshoppers, is to open that heart chakra when you and rent one of these movies.
Trying to change your consciousness here.
Oh yeah.
Hey, come on.
Get onto the alpha waves. Mm-hmm. Briefly, Seattle International Film Festival, if you pick up, I believe, The Stranger, which you brought in, you will have a listing of some of the highlights of that. And it's opening with a Shakespeare-ish movie.
Yeah.
Ish. Josh.
Not even ish. Apparently it's Shakespeare, yes.
It's Joss Whedon's take on Shakespeare. Yeah. Is it Shakespeare?
Yes, it's Much Ado About Nothing. It is the text. It's not like a 10 Things I Hate About You based on something else.
Okay.
And I haven't seen it yet, but it sounds like fun, and it sounds like the thing I wish more successful TV moguls would do. Go to turn to Shakespeare once in a while.
Well, as I understand it, he invited all his friends over to his house. I didn't see it. You probably did. And then he filmed them performing this in his house in black and white.
Something like that, yes. Okay. Over the course of, you know, a relatively few days after he's making blockbusters.
Anything else you're looking forward to on the lineup?
Well, they managed to snag the new Sofia Coppola film, The Bling Ring, for their clothing night, which is a North American premiere. So that's pretty good. Peter Greenaway is coming back for a personal appearance. He's been to SIFF before. But
I wasn't aware he was still alive.
He is still with us, and his movies have had a hard time getting released lately. But perhaps
are they going to screen some?
You know, they're going to screen a new film, but it also says he's actually going to give a kind of a lecture, although they would probably prefer me to use the word talk, on contemporary cinema's dependence on text leading to the death of cinema. It sounds like kind of like what we were just talking about. So we'll have to go check that out.
We will indeed.
Got the usual, you know, hundreds of movies. I'm sure we'll talk more about this when we get closer. And
well, it's only a couple weeks away.
Yeah, I'll see a few films. And May 16th is the opening date,
so
at any rate. Yeah.
2 weeks from tomorrow, if I'm doing my math correctly. There's also...
You just depressed me or panicked me. I'm not sure which.
STIFF. What does that stand for?
STIFF is the Seattle True Independent Film Festival, which is always offered around this time every year, kind of as an alternative to SIFF if you're looking for that kind of thing. And they go into the more underground and very, very outsidery sorts of films. And it opens this Friday and will be happening in the U District, including at the Grand Illusion. And kind of a nice little appetizer, you might say, for the SIFF, the monolith that is about to come.
And you'll need to get out of the sun, so that's all happening.
Oh, nobody wants that.
Carmig writes, Pixar's WALL-E visual film, In the Mood for Love, from Jordan. Yeah. There's a lot of them. Maybe we'll have... That'll be your next class at Seattle University.
Visual storytelling.
Yep. Robert Horton writes about film at his blog, The Crop Duster. Maybe he's written about this. You can also read his reviews at the Everett Herald. He hosts the monthly program Magic Lantern at the Fry Art Museum in Seattle, and we see him most Wednesdays here on Weekday. Thanks.
Thanks, Marcy.
Thank you.
10:39, a look at Amazon Fresh and the business of online grocery delivery services in a minute.
KUOW and the Seattle Public Library present Seattle Reads Gregory Martin's Stories for Boys, book at Repertory Theater staged readings, April 22nd, 28th, and May 4th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Well, let's take a look at the weather, shall we? It's 52 degrees and mostly sunny in Seattle, expecting sun all day with an afternoon high of 64. It's going to be sunny again tomorrow, Thursday, with a high of 70. And then currently the forecast shows sunny days with temperatures up into the 70s all the way through Tuesday.
Support for KUOW comes from Oiko Credit Northwest, presenting Empowered by Chocolate, an evening with the cocoa farmers of Ghana and their stories as a fair trade cooperative. May 9th at Wine World VIP Lounge, open to the public. Details at oikocreditnorthwest.org.
10:40, I'm Bernard Ouellette. In the news this morning, President Obama plans to name Tom Wheeler, a former cable and wireless industry lobbyist, to head the Federal Communications Commission. More about that in 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. In the dot-com heyday in Seattle more than a decade ago, we had online startups for almost everything, including groceries. Now Amazon Fresh, which is Amazon's experiment with online grocery orders delivered to your door, could be expanding. Joining us to talk about digital grocery shopping and more things tech is the co-founder and national editor of GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Hi.
Good morning, Marcy.
You actually use Amazon Fresh. I started thinking about this when I knew I was going to talk to you about it, about, I believe it was called homegrocer.com.
That's right, yeah.
So how is this service different from that one?
It's similar, although the web interface is very much improved over the days of the dot-com boom and bust.
Same idea, though, right?
Very much the same idea. You order your groceries online. They're delivered from a nearby warehouse as fresh as possible, although not always as fresh as you might get at the local store or the neighborhood grocer. But in general, the concept is the same. And Amazon has been doing this as a quote, pilot in the Seattle area since 2007. So for more than 5 years.
Really?
Yes. They started out on Mercer Island and expanded out from there. And it's the type of thing, they've been doing it so long, it would be a surprise at this point if they didn't ultimately expand to other markets.
Well, as you reported on GeekWire, they haven't announced an expansion, but they've bought some more refrigeration units.
It was one of the great tidbits from Amazon's earnings conference call last week. One of the analysts said, it was a great leading question. He said, hey, why have you guys been putting new refrigeration units into all of your distribution centers around the country? And he kind of surprised them.
Cold.
Yes, exactly. I don't think they need to, you know, be refrigerating those e-books necessarily.
Well, I've also read an interesting little study that if you shop at Amazon Fresh, you are a greener, more environmentally conscious grocery consumer than me who goes to the grocery store in my car.
Well, that is the findings of a study that came out from the UW that, in fact, the cumulative effect of all of those trips to the grocery store would actually be less than if we all just relied on one of those big trucks from Amazon to bring it to us. You know, it's an interesting study, and I don't know that Amazon will necessarily use it in their marketing or not, but it is... It's interesting to see that, you know, it could be a potential efficiency environmentally.
That's a long time for Amazon to be piloting. I mean, is it profitable? Do you know for them? They don't say it.
If it is, it's very marginally so. One of the things that I did in writing up a piece on this week was I went and I compared just a random sampling of 12 products at Amazon and then one at a major grocery store near me. And I found that on average, the prices were just about 12% higher on Amazon before the delivery cost. So they talk about trying to improve the business model and tweak things to make this work for them. I think that one of those things is testing pricing elasticity and seeing exactly what happens to the demand when they actually raise the prices.
How often do you use Amazon Fresh?
I use it 2 or 3 times a month. It has not yet been able to replace my family's entire grocery shopping, and in part because of the prices, even without analyzing them like I did. I think the average person looks at them and goes, you know something, a bell pepper should not cost that much. And so it is somewhat obvious on the face that you're paying a premium for the convenience.
I asked you whether Amazon had made a profit on it, but it's still, as I understand it, and hearing reports about Amazon's earnings report, like, profitability in this company's history has we're not really there yet.
They are certainly not Microsoft in this in this regard. You know, traditionally retailers have very slim profit margins, and Amazon is competing with many of those companies in the online world. And so Amazon's mantra is, hey, you know, they're going to focus on the customer, and over time, profits will come from that. And they try and get their shareholders to go along with that.
Well, they may not be filling their pockets, but they're definitely filling all those buildings they keep building in South Lake Union, up to 90,000 plus employees.
So that is the worldwide number for Amazon. It is. And a couple of caveats there. That includes some warehouse workers, quite a lot of warehouse workers, actually. But still, that is getting very close to Microsoft's global employment. You know, Microsoft having been around since the mid-1970s. So that just gives you some context and a benchmark there.
And how many of those workers are here, do you know?
Now, that's another thing. They do not say. So, for example, Microsoft will break it down and say, okay, of our 94,000, you know, roughly 40,000 of those are in the Puget Sound region. Amazon is a very private company in that they're closely guarded with a lot of their information.
Yes.
One of my favorite stories is of taking a tour with my colleague John Cook of the Amazon campus with official Amazon folks, a tour. And asking them, hey, what's in that building? And then telling us they couldn't tell us. And we're like, hey, you know, we're on a tour. I mean, Microsoft, they would never tell you that Windows wasn't in that building. It's a very different culture at Amazon.
Although Microsoft does have some secrets as well.
They certainly have some secrets, but they would never go so far as to not tell you generally what happened in a particular building.
We're talking with Todd Bishop of GeekWire, a regular guest on Weekday. And since we mentioned Microsoft, they're about to unveil the next generation of Xbox.
That's right. There's an announcement coming up later this month, now that we're in May.
When was the last Xbox upgrade or whatever it is?
Yeah, it was in 2005. So it's been a while. Now, I should say that is it depends on how you define an upgrade. They've made a series of updates. They make regular, you know, multiple times a year updates to the Xbox Live platform. They also had an improvement on the hardware, the Xbox 360 mm-hmm. Slim. But in terms of an entirely new console generation, it has been a long time since we've seen it.
Well, I mean, I'm the parent of a teenage boy, so I see gaming happening a lot. And I didn't realize there was that much hardware use. It seems like a lot of gaming, at least for older kids, takes place online.
Absolutely. And that is one of the things that Microsoft is going to try to address with the new console, the successor to the Xbox 360. One of the expected requirements, not confirmed but rumored, is that they will require an always-on internet connection. So one way or another, you're going to need to be connected to the internet to play. Now, of course, already you can play on Xbox Live, and online gaming has been around for a while, but the shift, if it happens, to a persistent online connection is really a recognition of the trend that you're talking about.
It got me to thinking more globally about the whole idea of hardware devices and tech companies. Microsoft has not had great success with its Surface tablet or
its
phone.
That's certainly fair to say.
No success might be better.
Very, very mild.
And so, I mean, I understand that there's a huge gaming population, but am I wrong in thinking perhaps if I were in charge of things over there, I might want to think more about online and less about hardware?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I think it's Crosscut has been doing a great series on what I would do if I were mayor. And we've thought, you know, maybe we should do what I would do if I were Microsoft CEO. So here you are starting the trend.
Well, and I don't know much about this, but all I know is that I use a piece of hardware,
yes,
a phone,
yes,
that I use to go online. It is a portal. It is not a device.
Absolutely. And that is the overriding trend. It's actually very astute that you're pointing that out. The devices that we're having and the hardware that we have in our homes and in our laps and in our pockets are increasingly just windows to this world that people sort of unfortunately call the cloud. It's really this connected world, and there are all these different devices that provide windows into it.
To use,
yes.
No pun intended,
yes.
There, because in fact that particular phone is, I mean, I think they're still making those Windows phones, but...
Oh yeah, I've got one right here.
Do you? You've been testing one, I think, but...
Yeah, I've been using one, yeah.
But we're talking about hardware devices, because Amazon, in addition to thinking about home grocery shopping, they've got a new box for on top of your television set. Is that a portal or is it a device?
So this was a report last week by a Bloomberg Businessweek reporter, Brad Stone, who's been writing a book about Amazon that's coming out soon. So this, again, is in the realm of things that Amazon has not yet confirmed. And, you know, we end up talking about things like this in the tech world quite a bit.
Well, it's fun to speculate.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yes, the report from Bloomberg Businessweek was that Amazon is coming out with its own set-top box as a new means of delivering Amazon Instant Video straight to your living room. So effectively competing with the Google TVs, the Apple TVs, and increasingly the Xbox 360s and the PS3s and the Wiis of the world.
Or the Netflix of the world.
Absolutely. Oh, and right now Amazon and Netflix are head-to-head on online streaming. That is, without question, one of the key tech battles to watch over the next few years.
I'm thinking somebody mentioned the movie WALL-E when we were talking to Robert Horton, and that's like one provider of all things. Is that Amazon's goal, to be the one, like the one ring in The Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, certainly. They want to get as close to that as they can. I think with strong companies out there like Google and Apple, and if Microsoft can have some kind of resurgence on this front, then eventually there will be a very competitive marketplace for all these things.
Before we go talking about phones, we've got a couple of comments from listeners back to talking about Amazon Fresh. Walter, who is a farmer in Ferndale, says if we're going to talk about the energy cost from farm to distribution point, we should be thinking about carbon footprints. He's written a book. A tomato from Whatcom County sold in Ballard has the same carbon footprint as a tomato grown in Phoenix. That's food miles. Matt says, I'm not a transportation logistics expert, but I think you need to be a little more careful about drawing broad conclusions from one study. Seems to me the story must be much more complicated than it's being portrayed in the media and possibly the study, although I imagine they were clear about assumptions.
Yeah.
Much love.
I'll tweet a link to the story from the GeekWire account, and maybe the KUOW Weekday account could.
We could do that. I think so. And then you can read it, because we are just chatting amiably about that. And we were more interested in the fact that they might be expanding than whether it's green to do that. Because really, if we were all green, we would have a plot of land that we'd be growing our own food on and only eating within 50 miles or whatever.
Right. But certainly scrutiny of these research reports is very important.
All right. So now I want to go back to phones, because you pulled your phone out.
My Windows phone. My HTC 8X.
And you like this phone.
I do. I actually just wrote an update this morning. You know, there are... I have something of a love-hate relationship with this phone. I love things like the auto-fill text feature that's far superior to iPhone. I hate things like the fact that when you take a video, if it's a 40-second video clip and you just want to trim it down to 30 to, you know, take out something at the end, you literally cannot do it on Windows Phone. It's not built into the platform, and it's not available through a third-party app. And it's just one of those head-smacking moments where you go, wait a second, what's happening here? So it is very love-hate for me with Windows Phone.
Well, app developers, you just heard
what
Todd's looking for. How many of these phone devices do you actually own?
Do I actually own?
And use. Is this the one you use?
Yes. So my experiment was to, whole hog switch to Windows Phone. And I did that in January. It's the primary one I use. I still carry an iPhone 4S.
Okay, I'm just...
Because there are a couple of apps that I particularly like. I love the Stitcher app. I love the voice recording native app on the iPhone, and mm-hmm. I use it as part of my work almost every day.
Well, now, speaking of iPhone, their iPhone's touted Siri has competitors from all sides.
Yes.
Google and
absolutely.
Facebook and, Android apps. So what are we looking at when we think about, the next generation of of any of these phones.
Absolutely. All of these different service providers are trying to essentially create your mobile home, if I could use that phrase, your mobile hub. So Google this week just came out with an expansion of one of its services that essentially provides real-time cards that are, you know, context-related. For example, if you're driving to a certain place for an appointment, it will automatically know, hey, let's surface the driving directions. And they expanded that from Android to iOS this week.
And is this meant to compete with Siri? Or?
In some ways, yes. And if you've never used the Google app on your iPhone, just the straight Google search app, try the voice recognition technology. By far, the best voice recognition technology that I've ever used.
This isn't Google Now?
Well, Google Now actually ties into this.
Okay.
And this entire app includes Google Now, and it also has this just fantastic speech recognition. You can speak a sentence, and as you're speaking it, it finds the words and starts conducting the search.
And that's for iPhone?
That is for iPhone. They also have this technology in Android as well.
And what is the Facebook Android app?
Yeah, so this is called Facebook Home. It's been a flop so far.
Ah.
Lots of uninstalls, not very favorable reviews. It's an Android app that essentially replaces your opening experience on Android for specific Android devices, to where you open it up and it's all about your friends, and you use this to essentially interface with your world through your, quote, social graph, as Facebook calls it.
Okay, so why do I want to do? I'm sorry, I'm too old. Why do I want that?
Exactly.
I don't want that.
Well, I can tell you why Facebook wants it, and I think this is an example of perhaps one company's strategy trumping its attention to what users would actually want. You know, you want to go into your phone and really essentially use what's there. Check your email. I think most people are still trying to look for the basics,
mm-hmm.
look for the weather. To me, viewing the world as a starting point through my friends is not where I want to be, even if Facebook wants me to be there.
Is that some monetizing strategy?
Certainly, to the extent that they're increasing people's attention to their system. I don't know if it actually has ads in it right off the bat, but that is definitely where Facebook needs to head on mobile.
Somebody's correcting me. We would not be greener if we all grew our produce in our backyards. So
okay, we've jumped into an environment.
Yeah, no. Let's just talk about tech here. I'm sorry, Lee.
No, that's good. It all interrelates.
Well, no, I mean, while we're talking about, you know, our whole phone, our mobile device, maybe a bigger device,
yeah,
being in our pockets or in our purses or wherever we put this device, it got me to thinking what that does to us as humans. And I know that's not your job necessarily to think about, but,
you know,
the fact that I have the ability to check my work communications 24 hours a day means that I do actually check. I don't check it 24 hours a day, but I certainly am more tied to things that we used to be able to leave behind. And whether I want to or not, it takes a different kind of willpower.
It does. There's this trend. Some call it the Sabbath day. There's a day called the National Day of Unplugging, where you're challenged to set your phone aside. John Cook, my colleague, mm-hmm. did this past year.
And how hard was it for him?
It was difficult. And the key was for him to actually schedule out activities, not just have things happen randomly, but say, okay, I know that I'm going to be doing this, this, and this, and I'm going to leave my phone at home. And basically, he distracted himself for the 24 hours as a kind of way of getting through it.
Because it is a little bit like an addiction.
It is.
Because I can, Todd, tweet something or email you or send you a photo or, you know, take a photo of my new cat. Not a cat or dog. I do. It's possible, therefore I do it.
Absolutely. I've started to take some pride in just leaving my phone in my pocket, you know, if we go to the park or something like that, and trying really to be in the moment. And I think we will see something of a not a backlash, but at least some kind of trend in that direction. I hope.
Do you have teenagers?
No, a toddler.
Well, it'll be different by the time that toddler gets to be 18.
Yeah, it'll be just embedded into our brains at that point.
The little chip in the head. Todd Bishop is the co-founder and national editor for GeekWire. We're not environmentalists in this particular discussion. He's a regular Wednesday guest, and we're going to stay away from green the next time we meet.
Okay, all right. Minefield.
Nice to have you here. Our show, as always, is on our website, kuow.org. You can search for separate interviews or, a little later today, find and replay this one. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and sometimes Andy Hurst when he's around. I'm Marcy Silman in for the sabbaticaling Steve Scher until October 1st. Bernard, take it away.
Sabbaticaling. I like that. Basketball player Jason Collins came out this week, making him the first openly gay active player in the NBA. Being the first can be difficult. Were you the first to come out to your family or your coworkers or your church? Later today, we're talking about coming out under difficult circumstances, and we'd love to hear your story right now. 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. When did you come out, and what was it like for you? That's today during the noon hour. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the shops at Wallingford Center, offering organic and fair trade products from small independent businesses both in the U.S. and around the world. Open daily with parking provided. Learn more at wallingfordcenter.com. Life's necessities and little luxuries.
Darwin, Australia has about 100,000 people and about the same number of saltwater crocodiles.
Crocodiles are very dangerous, so you might want to stay away from the water's edge when your parents tell you to be safe.
Next time on The World, how the people of Darwin live with one of the most dangerous predators on the planet. Living with crocodiles, that story on The World.
Even the kids know what to do. That's this afternoon on
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.